Thank you, Alan. Okay. So I put together a little outline up there because by definition, this is going to be pretty foreign to a lot of people. The American system is, I would say, within the global context, weird. And that is because most of our law that is made in this area is made by litigation that ends up at the United States Supreme Court. And the reason for that is that the First Amendment that Professor Davis was talking about it's a constitutional doctrine. So the only ultimate say-so about what the Constitution says is the United States Supreme Court. That's what my business is trying to make law by litigating cases in court and eventually in the United States Supreme Court. And so there's a huge amount of litigation going on around the country. There's probably literally 300 different religious liberty cases, different litigation matters going on around the country right now. And so it's impossible for me to actually address all of those in this short time. So what I was going to do is focus on sort of three really big areas and try to draw a couple of common trends that are coming out of that. So the biggest news in the law over the last year was the decision in Hosanna-Tabor Evangelical Lutheran Church and School against Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. And if you can say that three times in a row quickly, then you get a prize. This was a case that the United States Supreme Court decided earlier this year. This was a Beckett Fund case, so we brought this case to the United States Supreme Court, and we managed to get a reversal and a ruling in favor of our client, the church, 9-0. And the case was about what's called the ministerial exception, which in American law is a category of autonomy rights for religious groups, particularly churches. And the idea is that the laws that would normally apply to employment relations, so you can't discriminate on the basis of race, you can't discriminate on the basis of religion, you can't discriminate on the basis of disability, do not apply to a church's selection of its clergy. So if a Catholic church wants to hire only male priests, the U.S. federal courts and state courts have nothing to say about that. And this right had been recognized ever since the employment discrimination laws were passed, but the United States Supreme Court had never talked about it. And what was remarkable about the case was that a couple of things. One is that the court absolutely rejected my opponent's position at the United States Department of Justice, which was to say that there shouldn't be much of a ministerial exception at all. There shouldn't be this religious autonomy right. And they made that argument for the first time in Supreme Court. They'd never made it before, and it got rejected resoundingly. It was a unanimous decision. And I can tell you that unanimous decisions in religion clause cases in the United States Supreme Court are extremely rare. They happen very, very rarely. This is not the only one, but it's not something that comes up. There's some other remarkable things about it. Nobody ever knew why the ministerial exception existed. You know, what's the theory for it? And if you look under B up here, the court made a pretty amazing holding that no one expected, which was that it's based both in the idea of disestablishment and it's based in the idea of collective religious freedom. So religious freedom for groups or churches. And so to explain that and to kind of spell that out a little bit, the Establishment Clause, the U.S. Establishment Clause, is part of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and it says that Congress shall make no law respecting a establishment of religion. And basically that was a rejection by the revolutionaries the people who had just fought the revolution against England, of the English system. So the English system said you can have a nationwide state church, the Church of England, England, and in fact, they still have that today. And so they're trying to figure out who the Archbishop of Canterbury is going to be right now, and the Prime Minister actually has some say-so over that. That's completely out in the United States because of the Establishment Clause. And what the court said is, because of that history, because of the rejection of the English system in the United States Constitution, that that you could not have U.S. government officials in U.S. courts choosing ministers, which is what this would have amounted to. Another thing about the case that's really interesting is that they said that there's a collective religious freedom. And if you look under C, I spell that out a little bit more. It's an absolute right of churches, synagogues, and other houses of worship to choose their ministers and determine their beliefs without any government interference. So I think that's a really important thing to remember about this case, is that it's an absolute right. There's no balancing. There's no looking at what the government interest is. The court just says churches get to decide, and that's it. That's a very remarkable kind of holding. And one thing that's really interesting about it to me is that it's showing a convergence with international human rights norms. In European law, there's the idea of the forum internum and the forum externum that goes to individuals have a conscience. And what the court did in this case was essentially say that there's a forum internum for churches. They get a space that's free from government interference, that where they get to make up their mind about what they believe. They get to decide what their creed is, and they get to pick the people without government interference who decide what that creed is. And that's a really kind of remarkable development. And we actually just filed a brief at the European Court of Human Rights on Monday in the Sindicatul Pastor Salbun case against Romania, where we made exactly that point. We said there's a convergence between European law and American law. And I think it's a remarkable thing that I think shows that there's a common idea, even though they're using completely different legal systems, completely different jurisprudential background, completely different historical background, there's a sense where the theory at the bottom of it all is very similar. There's this idea that there should be this sphere that's inviolate. So we'll see what happens with that case. And I apologize again, I'm going to be rushing through this stuff because it's just impossible to get all the complexities. It took us a year to litigate this case. So, and there were, you know, 21 different amicus briefs filed on our side, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of briefing at the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'd encourage you to just go to our website if you want to really learn about the case. You can find out a lot at our website, which I suppose I can plug here, www.beckettfund.org. So that's a major development. And what's going to happen going forward is the court is going to tell us what that religious group rights means in other contexts. So not just the ministerial context, but in other contexts like these conscience cases, which is the second category of cases I wanted to talk about. Conscience cases are cases where there's a government regulation that orders someone, either a person or a institution, to do something that goes against their religious conscience. There's two classes of cases I'm going to talk about that we're involved in. One is pharmacist conscience cases. These are pharmacists who do not want to give out drugs that, in their view, are abortifacient, that is, cause an abortion after a pregnancy has started. These are called, in American parlance, they're called the morning after pill and the week after pill. They would terminate a pregnancy in the view of these pharmacists. So they don't want to hand out these drugs. So in Washington, there's two cases going on right now, one in Washington State in the Northwest and one in Illinois. We're handling both of those cases, and we've won in both of those cases so far. And what the courts have said is that the government doesn't have a right to force someone, based on the regulation, they don't have a right to force someone to hand out a drug that they think is killing someone else. And the reason is because the law is not neutral or generally applicable. They're going after these pharmacists. Some of you may have heard of Governor Rod Blagojevich. He's a pretty famous guy in the United States because he's now serving time in a federal prison for corruption. He's the guy that promulgated the Illinois anti-pharmacist conscience provision and said the pharmacists have to hand out whatever drugs. We invoke him frequently because everybody knows he's not such a great guy. He passed this law, and we've gotten it overturned at the Illinois appellate courts, and it's probably going to go to the Illinois State Supreme Court. The bigger set of cases is one that you all may have heard about, which is the federal abortifacient and contraceptive mandate. And there's 33 cases around the country. This is a mandate that was passed under the health care reform law, so-called Obamacare, that was passed a couple of years ago. And under that law, the government passed some regulations that say every employer that has more than 50 employees must provide in their employee insurance plans these drugs, the abortifacients that I mentioned recently, and contraceptives, just regular oral contraceptives. This violates the conscientious provisions of Catholics and Protestants. How am I doing on time?
Another minute or two.
Okay, I'll try to speed up. So there's 33 cases around the country on this. Now, the election may end up affecting this. It could be that a Romney administration would just get rid of this rule. I'm sure that if we get a second Obama administration, it won't. If it continues, it will go to the Supreme Court. This will be a case that goes to the Supreme Court. We actually just filed another one of these lawsuits this morning in Texas on behalf of a couple of Baptist universities. Not Baylor, I'm sad to say, but we filed another one of those this morning challenging the federal government on this. I'm going to skip the last one, number three, because we don't have time. But we represent entities like a mosque in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, challenging local government regulation that's essentially designed to suppress specific disfavored religious groups. What are the trends? So one is that you've got the growth of the regulatory state. It's going to be inevitable that we're going to have these conflicts because of the growth of the regulatory state. As it expands, it moves into new areas that were formerly areas of private law that included private religious belief, private religious principles. And so when it occupies more territory, you're inevitably going to end up with conflicts based on these new regulations. I don't want to compare it to the incredible blob, but there's definitely an aspect of that where people have to feel like they have to fight back against a growing regulatory state. So it's inevitable based on that. I would say also that often government officials are using the law to advance positions in ideological, sociological, and religious disputes. So you see this in some of the things that Tina may talk about with anti-Sharia legislation. Or anti-Sharia laws going after Muslims. That's an important trend and one that, in my view, has to be fought vigorously. And then finally, there's a new focus in American law, especially based on the Hosanna Tabor case, on the rights of religious groups. We've always talked about it in terms of rights of the individual, and we're moving to a time where the rights of religious groups are going to become a big issue. So, and I apologize for...